Good morning, I'm Damien Wilde, and welcome to a week of special EG broadcasts from our studio in London. We, like many of you, of course, were supposed to be in Cannes this week. Coronavirus, or rather the threat of it, has kept us here. Nevertheless, the show must go on. This year, for the first time, EG teamed up with the government to curate a programme of events on what was to be a spectacular UK pavilion. We didn't want to let all that work go to waste. It would be impossible to recreate the full spirit of MIPIM here in a slightly grey London, but we can at least stage many of the events we had planned so meticulously and bring them to you live or on demand if you're listening later. And to make everyone feel better, I notice there's no difference in temperature right now between London and Cannes. So thanks to all our partners for helping make this week's events possible. And we'll get straight down to our opening session. As it would have been in Cannes, we are kicking off by looking at how the UK is ready for business. And to do so, we have a great panel. With me is Kelly Hatton, partner at Shoesmiths, Bill Hughes, who's head of Real Assets at Legal and General Investment Management, Matt Oakley is head of European Commercial Research at Savills, and Joe Sarling is head of research and analysis at Homes England. So should we get it out the way and deal with the reason why we're here in the studio and not down in No More Sunny Cannes this week, and just talk a little bit about how we went into this year feeling like we had certainty and predictability, and you know, we could all sail on confidently about the months ahead. But with coronavirus, is that affecting the Boris bounce? What does it mean for vendors? What does it mean for investors? And will opportunities be in any way limited? Matt?
I'm delighted you came to me first, Damien, on that one, because
it's a pleasure.
I'm by no means an epidemiologist or a virologist. So what can I say? I think, you know, there undeniably was a pickup in interest almost instantaneously after the general election result. And we saw about 20% of all the money invested in commercial property last year was transacted in December. And that clearly did continue into January, particularly in the London market. I was never totally convinced that the election result meant that everything was plain sailing ahead. And my standard first slide of pretty much every presentation I do is, you know, Brexit is still there and still to be done, and the deal is incredibly complicated. So I don't think, you know, the boom in investor confidence is necessarily rational, but it's very, very welcome. Will coronavirus affect it? I don't think it will dramatically. I think, you know, the UK government's playing a pretty sensible line. We're definitely seeing corporates sort of pulling in their horns, maybe slightly overreacting to that. But I think, you know, maybe I'm an optimist, but I always come back to the fact that, you know, in difficult times, investment in real estate tends to do better than other asset classes. So with the collapse in the stock markets, the fall in base rates, you know, property once again looks quite attractive.
You think that's in the immediate term, or will recover within a small number of months? How do you think Q2 will fare?
Investment-wise, I think, you know, the Q2 deals are probably pretty much underway, but that's probably more an area for sort of Bill to comment than me. You know, the worry is probably on the occupational side for me. You know, it's very much a demand-led shock to the UK economy or the global economy. So, you know, if everyone does sort of panic buy and everyone stops travelling, there will be a short-term economic shock, but I think it will be a sort of V-shape. It'll be sharply down and then sharply up. So again, I think, you know, I'm not particularly worried about the sort of the full year outlook for real estate. I think, you know, it looks quite attractive, and I think, you know, money will keep coming to the UK because of the political certainty point.
Well, there's no doubt at all coronavirus is having a huge impact on the country at the moment. We saw yesterday that translating into huge market volatility. The market's experiencing their worst performance in a decade. Other pricing is reflecting the turbulence in the market. So gold is at all-time highest pricing, and some government bonds are now in negative yield. So no doubt at all this is impacting. I try and take two positives from where we're at the moment, though. The first one is this crisis is certainly a temporary one, which is very different to the financial crash in 2008. For this crisis now, there are no underlying structural problems with the economy. This is very much a natural disaster, which hopefully will peak and then will pass in a matter of weeks or months. All the rest of the fundamentals of the economy are still performing strongly. So I take some comfort from that. And also, yes, this is a crisis, but what do people do in a crisis? They look for stability and they look for safe havens. And I like to think that the UK real estate market offers those things. UK is a very transparent system. We're very robust in terms of how hopefully we're going to respond to this crisis. And I think, as I say, the messages of stability and a safe haven should hopefully mean that UK real estate is still seen as a safe place for international investors to put their investment.
Few months, that may feel like a long time to some people. You think it's months rather than weeks, though, in terms of the impact on this market?
Yeah, I think it's going to take a while when deals have slowed and demand has slowed down. I think it will take a while to come back. I think another interesting thing will be whether the changes in lifestyle that we're all having to make now, you know, a lot of meetings have been cancelled. We're doing a lot more video conferencing, a lot more agile working. I think that will be interesting to see which aspects of those stick with us and change the nature of office demand and how organisations want to structure their businesses going forward. So I think that will be interesting to watch.
I'd be interested to see whether we leave this studio very much in the next few months, actually. And Bill, how about you? Has it changed activity for L&G?
Yeah, I think I would differentiate between the different timeframes here. So what we're experiencing now is all about sentiment, and everyone's reading the papers. There's new information coming in. Clearly, at one level, coronavirus is escalating. But really, it's too early to see what's going to be happening with the behaviour of occupiers and trading performance and the extent to which business adapts. I think that starts to be evident several weeks hence, and there's no doubt there's going to be a slowdown. That's already pretty evident to me. But I do go back to the idea of real estate being a long-term asset class, and actually decisions that we can make today are really for the next 5, 10, 20, even 40 years. And to that extent, there's definitely opportunities out there. The one thing that I think is potentially a positive in some ways is that this is causing people to really think hard about their own supply chain and not be complacent about that, which is, I think, to some extent where we've got to. And as it so happens, organisations that thought hard about what might the impact of a hard Brexit be will have been thinking about how do they source locally, how do they ensure that they've got some sort of resilience in the supply chain. So slightly bizarrely, some of the preparations for Brexit here I think are really relevant.
Okay, and last year, and we'll come back to some of those longer term factors in a moment, but just sticking with the shorter term, that last year Brexit uncertainty affected the investment markets more than the occupational markets, but you'd expect coronavirus to affect the occupational markets more than the investment markets.
I think the potential is there for both. If you consider what it would be to be a retailer at the moment and your shopping centre that you're located in is empty or certainly very, very low footfall compared to normal, they're going to struggle. There's no doubt about that. The question becomes really how long will that go on for? And I think I'm in the camp of saying that's going to be months rather than weeks, but not longer.
And is it changing your property management strategies and execution as well?
I think it's caused us to take a fresh look at how close to the occupiers, how close to the assets we are. As it happens, we made some real changes in that area in calendar year 2019 and staffed ourselves and organised ourselves differently. So we are much more in tune with what's happening at an occupier local level than ever we were, and that's standing us in good stead.
Okay, thank you. And Joe, before we move on from this topic, I promise we will move on. I just wonder, is it changing Homes England and the decisions you're taking in the short term? I see on Twitter this morning Nick Walkley is striding around Newcastle, presumably looking at opportunities, but has there been an impact?
Well, it's fair to say that he's got a strong Twitter game when he goes out and about, so there'll be plenty of photos.
A few stronger.
Yeah, exactly. So I think a few things actually to tease out here before I answer your question directly. So I think, first of all, COVID-19 is absolutely a supply-side shock, and that supply-side shock hits all of the supply chains, and I absolutely agree with Bill, actually, in the preparations for the UK exit from the EU, actually a lot of that preparation now comes into play and comes into force, and I think that's really, really helpful, actually. I think secondly, as this is a global issue, I'm really interested in the global response, first and foremost, and I'm naturally going to look at the markets here, I'm naturally going to understand what's going on. And really interestingly, the global response so far has been pretty substantial, and when I'm thinking about in the next few months, its potential for a huge fiscal expansion, notwithstanding the point that there's no room to manoeuvre in monetary policy quite so much anymore, but the fiscal expansion should help prop up some of the sectors and the economy, and I'm quite interested in the real estate dynamic of that and the opportunities that comes from that. I think fundamentally, though, that there's a long-term versus short-term thing, and I think we've discussed that already, and real estate absolutely is a long-term thing. In the immediacy, I think that whilst there are challenging economic conditions, totally understand that, both with COVID-19 and more broadly, actually the fundamentals remain really strong. We have low unemployment, we have good wage growth, good jobs growth, credit availability. That's all really positive. It's not that the entire situation is dire. So our ability and our resilience to hit some of these things is really, really good. And particularly to overcome some of the challenges COVID-19 and other things would hit. But I think then more long term, and I'm sure that we'll come to this on a longer discussion, but more long term, actually the long run fundamentals are really still strong. I mean, between now and 2041, there'll be an extra 4 million households. I mean, these are really big decisions that go well beyond the next few weeks, next few months. So notwithstanding that, to come back to your question, Damien, I think the fundamentals are strong for us. I think Homes England are making sure that we prepare. As the government's housing delivery agency, we have a strong role, an important role there, to make sure that we understand what would the knock-on impact be for the diversity of the market, or what would that mean for supply chains. We need to take a lead of that. We will take a lead of that in terms of our delivery and how we work with partners on the ground. I think that's really important.
And you're patient, Bill's patient as well, in a capital sense, but at the moment you are taking that long view, and it's changing your day-to-day decision making little so far.
Absolutely, we take that long-term view. We're here for the long term. The crisis that we've faced in the housing sector more broadly has been generations in the making, and so we are here for the foreseeable future and for time to come. So we have to take that long-term view. But with that long-term view means that, you know, our patient capital, we will take on some of the risk that the market won't necessarily do so. And I'm really keen to make sure that our partnership working allows us to unlock some of that.
Okay, Bill.
Yeah, I do think that some organisations will sit on their hands and stop now. And against the context of this being a long-term asset class that requires a lot of investment, and by that I mean not just real estate and housing, I mean infrastructure as well. Those that carry on, actually, and we had this in the world post referendum in 2016, for a few years there's fewer players, and that for those that are willing to commit and continue to invest, they will see less congestion and they'll actually see better opportunities.
Okay, thank you. Let's jump straight to the long term. Bill, I'll carry on with you for a moment. We've got a budget tomorrow. Infrastructure probably isn't going to play a big part in that. It sounds like that's a little later coming. But do you think there's the boost and the advantage of having a government that understands the importance of long-term investment in infrastructure and the role that real estate can play?
Yeah, I think in the next small number of budgets, and it may well be the next one rather than tomorrow, I think there will be some exciting commitments to long-term investment and infrastructure from the government. You know, the PM has set that out. That seems to be very much the subplot. It just so happens that the budget we're going to see tomorrow is not going to address that much of it. It seems, because of obvious near-term issues. But in the long run, I think investment in infrastructure that relates to the so-called levelling, right? So getting other parts of the UK to grow at a faster rate than London and the South East, I'm fully supportive of that, and we'd expect to see more commitment to devolution, again very supportive of that, to the extent that that can elicit local local better decision making, and in the short term can be a stimulus. So I'm pretty excited. It just that we won't see it on the 11th of March, I doubt.
And Joe suggested there could be some relaxing of the fiscal rules there, which allow for more government investment. But do you think it's also understood that the private sector needs to play a big role here as well? Or might that some of those decisions come despite the private sector?
I think there's a recognition that there's a big role for the private sector to play, and if long-term capital sees the opportunity for what it is, then long-term capital and the private sector will participate in investing in the built environment of the future in the UK. And I would take the view that the government simply can't afford to do that on its own, and it's totally coherent. Whether or not this short-term obsession with coronavirus gets in the way of that for a number of weeks, well, possibly, but we're certainly open for business in that way.
Okay, and Matt, from the clients you talk to, if they're trying to look beyond the short term, are they looking as far as that very long term picture, or is there somewhere in between that they're shooting at?
I think it varies, to be honest. You know, there are some clients who like Bill view real estate as part of the infrastructure story, who are prepared to take a very long view. I would say the majority are looking comparatively short term, and they're looking at, you know, is the UK cheap? Was the UK cycle delayed by the sort of the post-referendum period? Does that mean we've got a bit more rental growth to come in the UK than perhaps in other markets? You know, are the markets just undersupplied because developers have been reasonably inactive? You know, they're looking at the really simple metrics and just saying, well, is there a better growth story in the UK than perhaps in mainland Europe? And I think, you know, regardless of sort of COVID-19, the answer is undeniably yes. You know, the UK has missed out on growth in the sort of rental growth in the last 2 or 3 years. It will outperform much of Europe, and certainly, you know, my clients, you know, whether they're coming from North America or from Asia Pac, are all just looking at the UK and going, we're underweight, there's a good growth story, we will deploy capital if we can find something to buy. And actually the biggest challenge, you know, going to Jay's point, you know, it's is the supply side on that. You know, there just isn't a lot of stock to buy out there unless you want to buy a big, partially vacant mall.
Okay. And from a relative value point of view, the UK looks like it does offer relative value compared to some of mainland Europe. But how about within the UK? Is there opportunity outside of London? Is that where people are increasingly looking?
Not enough, to be honest. I think
not enough opportunity, or not enough.
No, I think I don't think enough people are looking outside London. You know, the majority of capital, you know, is non-domestic probably at the moment, that's looking at the UK. And you know, we're all relatively risk averse. We tend to go to the capital city first when we go abroad, and so they look at the capital city. I think, you know, the growth story is stronger outside London over the next decade than it is in London, for you know, infrastructure reasons, for rebalancing reasons, for North Shoring, et cetera, et cetera. The challenge for a lot of my clients is just, you know, these are very, very small markets, and actually deploying a large amount of capital into the UK regions, whether you're a developer or investor, is quite challenging. You know, very few of the UK REITs invest outside London. So you know, there are challenges of getting invested outside London, but I think, you know, the supply and demand story is far more attractive in the office market outside London than it is in London.
Okay, I think Bill's about to try and persuade them.
Well, what I'd say, Matt, is I agree with most of what you said there, with the exception of the suggestion that there's a scarcity of opportunities. So what we would see is top 10 or 12 cities in the UK, if you get involved with the local authority, with the support of other agencies, sometimes higher education, which is a critical part of the future of many UK cities, there are in most cities some amazingly interesting several hundreds of million GDV opportunities over a period of time on a phased basis without taking excessive risk that really make a whole lot of sense. That's why LNG have been getting out on the road and investing in most of the UK cities. And I do think that is a very bright opportunity for investors. And those that concentrate just on London, I think, are rather missing a trick.
Yeah, and I think you're right, Bill. It's a short term versus long term. You're much more prepared to take a long term view than many real estate investors. I think a lot of people struggle with you know, the 5-year plays. Undeniably, there are some infrastructure based regeneration plays, you know, that will be better, you know, offer better opportunities.
Okay, Kelly.
I actually think the best opportunities are going to be in the north. All projections show that growth will be higher in the north than in the south. And from, you know, a lot of our clients now are saying, you know, London is just too hot, that the pricing just doesn't work for London. So they are looking at whether it's the secondary cities, the, you know, Manchester and Birmingham and Leeds. Some are even saying that those markets are now too hot. I mean, still lots and lots of activity and great transformations of those cities. But I think the really, really interesting opportunities that aren't being tapped into are perhaps those tertiary locations, you know, the smaller cities and the towns. And I agree with Bill that, that if you go looking for these opportunities, particularly in partnership with the local authorities or higher education institutions, there's some really quite spectacular schemes there. And I think the key is approaching the local authorities who, in our experience, in you know, we act for quite a lot in the north, they are hugely willing to engage and they understand that developers will only take a certain level of risk. And we're putting in place all sorts of innovative structures for how schemes in the north can be viable and how we can create structures where that, that risk profile does actually work for the private sector. So, you know, we take Sheffield, for example, there's a huge amount of public and private partnership going on there, and with the university, other regional regeneration projects in Stockport, Bolton, all of these are fantastic schemes where the local authorities are working hand in hand with the private sector. So I think there's some real gems of opportunity there.
Joe, you must have a catalogue of opportunities in these places and others.
That is a brilliant plug, and that's exactly what I was going to say. Let's start from first principles here. The government has a clear ambition to build 300,000 homes a year, and at a record year and record data so far, we've built 250,000. That's an incredible achievement, yet still 50,000 short. So we need a push on, and pushing on becomes incrementally more and more difficult. So we need to be a little bit bolder in this. I think that's really important. Secondly is, and moving away from some of the numbers and the market here, anecdotally, I think it's really interesting to come to various points already made. I had a series of conversations at Expo in Munich last year where they sent the pitch to them from them was, where should we invest? They have the capital, where should we invest? And so I'm talking about a few places outside of London, the major cities, some of the towns, some of the opportunities that we have. And their first response was, oh, we've only looked at London. When you drilled in a little bit more, they've only looked at basically zone one of London. No wonder this is difficult. So there's a little bit of an education point here, but there's certainly yields to be had across the country, and we would definitely support that.
We have been talking about that education for some years, though. If it hasn't moved on already, will it?
I genuinely do think it will. I take your point that we have been talking about that for years. I think actually Homes England plays a really strong role in that, being a convener of different parties helps us do that. Coming back to an original point early on in the conversation, Homes England and the government absolutely don't want to do what the market would already do. There's absolutely no need for that, and it would be a waste of taxpayer money to do so. So we want to look for new opportunities where the market wants some support and some assistance. So I do think we play a huge role actually in the convening power of bringing different people and different organisations together to really push on, and the education point really ticks that box. But I think fundamentally this comes down to there are opportunities across the country. Housing delivery test, for example, that was recently published by the department is really important in this, and it shows huge undersupply in actually some really key areas. Of course, there's, you know, big swathes of areas across the southeast, which we absolutely shouldn't neglect because high growth area. But actually urban areas massively underperform in terms of delivery. Oxcam area needs a real boost. So some really interesting examples here that actually, coming back to a point that maybe we will go on and speak about, I think the real innovation coming up, the real innovation for the sector as a whole will be finance. I think it will be, how do we structure deals? How do we repurpose JVs and so on? And I think Homes England will play a huge role in doing that.
And just briefly, because I do want to move on again, we're up against the clock as ever. If it's a struggle to convince international investors to look beyond London and look at other cities across the UK, how hard is it going to be to get them to support that levelling up agenda and look at towns as well?
No, it's a really fair point. What I would say, though, is that it's difficult in the first instance because potentially institutional investors come and understand the country from a very narrow perspective. And actually, I think when you sit down and discuss not only the business fundamentals of investment into real estate, but also just the principles of why we're doing it and place shaping and creating great places and the opportunities here, and this is the heritage and this is what we're trying to do, actually the persuasion is quite easy. So it comes down to the business fundamentals, what would work out, and Homes England sites are available there to help unlock some of those things. We'll have the convening power to make sure that we bring parties together where we get involved or otherwise. But I think that's the real power here, is a narrative, is a story, is telling the story about how real estate can really change and transform lives. And I think people get that.
Okay, Bill.
Yeah, I would say that our experience in recent years has been relatively successful in terms of making the case for non-London. We've had some really positive experiences in Japan, in the Middle East, in mainland Europe, where if you display the numbers and you tell the story and you show the narrative of devolution and the massive latent potential that many UK cities have that have experienced decades of underinvestment, it feels very compelling. And my sense, Damon, it would always help if there's a football team that plays there, because it's in the Premiership, because that gives a feeling of familiarity. And I'm only saying that slightly tongue-in-cheek. But many of the cities around the UK have got a story that is really well worth telling, and we've found that does get traction.
You're hoping Leeds get promoted, is that what you're saying?
Well, you know, Leeds have got a heritage football team, should we call it, and people do know about that and have heard about Leeds over many decades.
Okay, sorry, Leeds fans, a heritage football team there. Matt, very quickly, how about sectors? What sectors are proving attractive at the moment? You mentioned empty malls earlier. Should I take it that not retail is part of your answer?
A bit. You know, my sort of possibly bravest call for this year in terms of the sector that I think that will see the biggest increase in investment in percentage terms is retail. I think, you know, retail is not all bad.
You called it at the beginning of last year.
Yeah, true. But yeah, it's not all bad, but it's all priced as bad. And I think, you know, the pointy-toothed North American opportunity investors have just woken up to the fact that, you know, some very good retail in the UK is now very, very cheap. And I think, you know, there are bits that will see quite substantial increases. And obviously, we've already seen a significant amount of activity in the retail warehouse sector. But going back to your question, you know, the bulk of interest that I get is you know, office, well-let offices, well-let distribution warehouses. And then I rather grudgingly hand over the vast majority of money that's looking at the UK to my colleagues on the residential side of the business, because, you know, UK residential is, you know, as it evolves into a multifamily asset, is pretty much the top of every global institutional investor's shopping list at the moment. It offers the long income. They're not bothered about the comparatively low yields. It's a known global asset class. So now I find myself increasingly irrelevant when I'm talking to international investors, because I'm trying to push the same old product, and they're more interested in what we used to call alternatives that is no longer alternative.
So more patience in residential amongst residential investors than office investors?
Definitely. Absolutely. I think, you know, people buy it for the demographic change. They buy it because there is a global demand for sort of annuity matching type income. And they just look at the UK and go, you know, as Joe's point, we are fundamentally undersupplied. And you know, what better driver of investing in a class is there? Find an undersupplied asset class, buy it, build it, deliver it. So yeah, I think, you know, there are definite bright spots, but unfortunately increasingly more of them fall outside my area of expertise.
Okay, thank you. And Bill, purpose. You've been talking about purpose quite a lot recently. Is this transformational and changing decisions on a widespread basis about where to invest and occupational decisions as well?
You mean thinking about purpose as a starting point?
Thinking about ESG.
What is your intent? I do think there is much more recognition that having intent when you make decisions and thinking hard about the purpose is important, much underplayed in the past. Surprising, really, if you stand back from it and you're thinking about the fact we have an obligation to deploy capital in a way that has a point. I think it is a new emergence. I think I'm encouraged by what's happening. I don't hear dissent around that subject particularly. And the chances of the UK having a high quality built environment that works for society, I think, has materially increased because people are talking about it, thinking about it, and I think the quality of decisions and delivery will be much better.
And I suppose it's not just dissent isn't the only measure, an absence of dissent. It's about how many people are lining up behind the flag. And I know that there is more and more capital. You talked recently about 1.6 trillion of commercial worth of commercial property backing the PIA's ESG principles. Is that a, you know, is that army getting bigger every day?
I think it is. Yeah, you're right. There may well be some silent objectors that I wouldn't know about, but I feel the momentum around purposeful investment is very visible, here to stay, and those investors are going to be the winners. And I think we're in the process of creating examples of those winning investments, which will, I think, in time move the dissenters into action in a way that can also be constructive.
And you wrote for EG recently on an increasing tug of war between profit and purpose might now be starting to tip the scales. Is it still a tug of war, or can the two be complementary?
Yeah, I think I may have been misquoted there. I think of profit and purpose as being entwined. They're certainly not mutually exclusive. It's entirely possible to invest with purpose and be delivering the right level of returns to your investors. Probably the thing I do get back to again is the time frame over which that happens. There's a whole lot of difference between making short-term financial returns. And in that situation, I think it's harder to be purposeful as opposed to thinking longer term with a purpose. You can really make something happen and you can build some sort of sustainable, enduring investment that really works for everybody.
Okay, thank you. And Kelly, are your clients lining up? Are they talking to you about wanting to act purposefully?
Well, yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of our clients, a developer PLC, got a new chief exec in the last few weeks, and we had our first meeting, and the very first question...
Not so long ago, that would have narrowed it down. I'm not sure it does at the moment.
The very first question he asked was that he asked of us was, right, what we need to get our ESG policy up to scratch. This is my top priority. So that was really quite surprising, because I think historically we've always felt that this was, you know, that there were definitely some pioneers, maybe sort of Bridges Ventures. They were, you know, back in 2002 starting with this sort of model. And so the pioneers were almost seen as, oh, okay, great, you go and do that, where the rest of us will just concentrate on making money. I think now that there has definitely been a big shift. We saw BlackRock making a pretty significant announcement about the types of investments they were no longer going to make. They were going to move away from fossil fuel and put climate strategy at the heart of their strategy. So these movements from the investors, I think that is going to be the next shift, because if people are not going to get the investment, if they don't demonstrate the right values and results in terms of ESG, then I think that is where it is going to start hitting the bottom line. Until now, it's been a nice to have, but I think any companies which don't embrace this fully are sure enough going to see this hit their bottom line, because they simply won't get the investment. I think the big challenge for us in the next few years is a lot of this stuff is quite hard to measure. Maybe, you know, there are obviously some key standards around sustainability. Everyone's very familiar with BREEAM. That's on every heads of terms that you see. But there's quite a lot of new standards, you know, tons of jargon. It's a bit of an alphabet soup of different ways of measuring these things. And that's just on sustainability. Then you go into social impact. That's even harder to measure. So I think the challenge for the industry is to come together and agree on what these standards are. And I think that will need some direction from government as well, to say how are you going to be measured as a company in terms of ESG. And then the industry can kind of galvanise around that and start to develop and innovate the tools that we all need to then demonstrate these capabilities and values in our investments and our development. So I see that as the next stage, really, getting into the granular way of measuring these things, and then making sure that, you know, all the developments can actually tick the boxes in a very meaningful way.
Okay, thank you. And Joe, last word.
Yeah, just very briefly, I completely agree with all of that. And I think actually from a Homes England perspective and a government perspective, I'm most excited about the sectors, as it were, coming closer together. A lot of the discussions at the moment about, the patient capital, but also with having those social goals and environmental goals, moves us closer to the goals that traditionally public sector would have. But equally, public sector now recognises the need to actually make sure that these projects stack up. And I think Homes England with other bodies in that, that comes really close to moving sites forwards, and that's really exciting.
So the public and private sector is better aligned as a result of all this?
I think so. And I think actually traditionally they haven't been that far apart in general. But I think in the narrative terms and how we see things in the sector as a whole, I think it's much more positive. And that's a really good thing.
OK, I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you all for coming in. Thank you for tuning in as well. And thank you to those of you who did post comments as well. We're going to be back just after 11 o'clock looking at driving inward investment and after lunch looking at infrastructure with more to follow on Wednesday and Thursday. So I hope you're all able to join us then. Thank you.